Good evening. You're listening to Outsources, a KGNU Boulder Denver program that brings you stimulating and thoughtful perspectives on the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer communities. I'm Angela Palermo, your host for the evening. As always, I'm happy to be here with you for another episode of Colorado's only homegrown, regularly scheduled LGBT-themed radio show. And I'm really excited to speak with tonight's guest. I don't think it would be an overstatement to say that no one believes that the Trump administration is in any way favorable towards the LGBT community. There's been a number of developments that are troubling. Everything from the Census Bureau retracting a proposal to collect demographic data on LGBT people in the 2020 census, to the staff at the Center for Disease Control not being allowed to say the seven words transgender, vulnerable, entitlement, diversity, fetus, evidence-based, and science-based, to the U.S. Department of Education announcing it will summarily dismiss complaints from transgender students involving exclusion from school facilities and other claims based on gender identity discrimination. Not to mention that the Supreme Court might hand down an anti-LGBT decision, with Neil Gorsuch now wearing the black robes in the masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, the so-called Colorado Bakery case. It's not an easy time being queer, especially for us transgender folks. With me on the phone to discuss this worrisome queerphobic trend is Chase Strangio. Chase is a staff attorney with the ACLU's LGBT and AIDS Project. Chase's work includes impact litigation as well as legislative and administrative advocacy on behalf of LGBTQ people and people living with HIV across the United States. Chase has particular expertise on the treatment of transgender and gender nonconforming people in police custody, jails, prisons, and other forms of detention. Prior to joining the ACLU, Chase was an Equal Justice Works Fellow and the director of the Prison Justice Initiative at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, where he represented transgender and gender nonconforming individuals in confinement settings. In 2012, Chase founded the Lorena Borjas Community Fund, an organization that provides direct bail and bond assistance to LGBTQ immigrants in criminal and immigration cases. He also gave one of the keynote addresses at the last Transforming Gender Conference on the CU Boulder campus in March of this year. Welcome, Chase, and thanks for taking the time to be on Outsources.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Lovely to have you. Getting started, I wonder if you might tell our audience a little bit about yourself. When and where did you grow up, and what was it like for you as a future queer?
I grew up outside of Boston in the 80s and 90s, and I had a really supportive, loving family, so that was good for me. But mostly I was really, you know, I was lucky because I was white and I had access to economic opportunities and was able to go to a private college and then law school. So all of those things really positioned me in the world to succeed systemically, and that obviously had a huge impact on my ability to survive and become an advocate for the community in the ways that I have been. But I didn't come out to myself as queer or trans until I was much older. Growing up was hard because I didn't have the language or self-confidence to really feel at home in my body or in my identity as a queer person.
Yeah, I think a lot of us went through that. So you were not out when you went to law school? Is that true?
I was out as queer starting after high school, and then I sort of out as gender nonconforming and sort of coming to terms with my identity a little bit more as I started law school and then came out as trans during law school.
And so what was it like to be a queer/trans person at law school?
Well, I went to a law school that was very public interest oriented, going into a space that was different than other parts of the legal profession that are very conservative and very much sort of invested in the maintenance of the gender binary and white supremacy, and sort of all law is to a degree, so it's impossible to escape that. But at least I was at a school that had like-minded peers and faculty, and so I was able to focus on the things that I cared about. It wasn't law school that I think was the hardest to navigate in terms of being a queer and trans person so much as the larger legal profession, and knowing that I was going to have to enter a courtroom or engage in these structures that were very much wedded to the gender binary and that I might not fit in, and sort of trying to find my voice and my power in that was definitely a process for me that was difficult.
And you served as the director of Prison Justice Initiatives at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. What did that work entail, and who and in what ways did you help?
Yeah, when I was at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, which is a collective organization here in New York City that works for gender self-determination through a racial and economic justice lens, I did a lot of work with people who are incarcerated in prisons and jails and other sites of confinement, and did a lot of work just ensuring that people had the ability to file for name changes, for legal name changes while they were detained, getting people access to health care, making sure people had access to support systems on the outside, working on bail advocacy for, especially for folks who are caught up in the criminal legal system and who are at risk of deportation. Did a lot of work with the community in New York City and learned a lot from the organizers in New York who have been sort of working against state systems for a really long time.
Did you know Dean Spade while you were at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project?
Yeah, so Dean Spade founded the Sylvia Rivera Law Project shortly after he graduated from law school and remained a collective member for my time there. So Dean was part of the project, and we worked together regularly and still do.
How did your time at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project ease your transition to the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union? And what sort of work did you initially do there at the ACLU?
It was a really good experience for me to work at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. I think I got important, I got important skills in terms of actually learning how to support grassroots movement as a lawyer, being able to recognize the harms that lawyers could potentially do to movements that have been in existence for a really long time. I mean, I spent a lot of time actually in prisons talking to people, connecting with the community, understanding the implications for the work. And so that was really important insight and experience before going into a larger national organization like the ACLU and having less contact with folks who are experiencing the most impact from discrimination and violence in our systems of government and law enforcement. So from being at Sylvia Rivera and having an all-trans, majority-trans, let's say, staff and being really connected to the community gave me important insight that I could then bring to the ACLU when navigating this sort of larger, more mainstream structure. And then here at the ACLU, I've done a lot of different types of work, from litigation on marriage equality to trans student work to more prison work, litigating cases for trans people in custody to gain access to safer conditions and health care has been a big part of my work here. And then doing legislative work to try to stop anti-trans bills, state legislatures across the country.
And your bio mentions working on impact litigation. Could you define that term for us? What does it signify? Might you give us an example of impact litigation?
Impact litigation generally just refers to litigation that is designed to change the law, and rather than not necessarily enforce existing laws, but really litigate to expand civil rights, like in the context of the ACLU, to litigate to expand civil rights protections and get courts to interpret constitutional protections and federal and state statutory protections to include a broader range of people and types of protections. It means bringing cases challenging bans on marriage for same-sex couples to fundamentally change the existing state of the law in the United States, and that would be one example, or cases like Gavin Grimm's case to get federal courts to make clear that federal law prohibiting sex discrimination in schools includes and encompasses discrimination against transgender students. So really getting the courts to clarify and expand or somehow, broaden through either clarity or expansion the nature of protections that people can enjoy under the statutory and constitutional protections that we have in this country.
And you mentioned the Gavin Grimm case. What were the circumstances there? Who is Gavin Grimm? Where did he or does he live? Can you tell us something about him and what he was trying to do, what his struggle was there?
Yeah, Gavin Grimm, done with high school, but when we started representing him, he was a high school student in Virginia, in Gloucester County, Virginia, who is a boy who's transgender, and he was trying to use the boys' restroom like other boys, and his school board passed a policy prohibiting him from using the boys' restroom because he's trans, and establishing a policy that trans students cannot use single-sex facilities that correspond with their gender. So Gavin filed a lawsuit with us. My colleague Josh Block was the lead attorney on that case, and he filed his lawsuit in 2015 against his school board, challenging that policy under Title IX, which is the federal law that prohibits sex discrimination in schools, and under the United States Constitution. And his case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court never resolved his case or the questions presented. After the election, there was a change in the enforcement practice of the federal government, and that sort of changed the nature of some of the questions presented to the court, so it went back down to the lower courts. And even though Gavin's actually graduated high school now, his case is still pending.
And it might go back to the Supreme Court, is that correct? It might they might actually hear the case, is that true?
They could, yeah. I mean, it would take a while, but it could definitely end up back there. It's now at the lower federal court in Virginia. So it takes a while to get through the courts, and it's no longer in the posture, it was before, which was on a preliminary injunction, so it was sort of more expedited at that time. But there's a number of cases pending in the lower courts and the lower federal courts that raise this question, the question of sort of the scope of sex protections under federal statutory and constitutional law. And that, you know, that issue could get back up to the Supreme Court again. And so hopefully when it does, the court will be ready to rule in our favor.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU. I'm your host, Angela Palermo. Today we're speaking with Chase Strangio. Chase is a staff attorney with the ACLU's LGBT and AIDS Project. His work includes impact litigation as well as legislative and administrative advocacy on behalf of LGBTQ people and people living with HIV across the nation. He also gives talks around the country on college campuses and elsewhere on LGBTQ advocacy and legal strategies. Speaking of college campuses, Chase, you gave the opening keynote address at the recent Transforming Gender Conference held on the CU Boulder campus in March of this year. At that talk, which you titled, We Just Need to Pee, the Trans Body in the Political Legal Realm, you stated that the LGBT community and political progressives in general should not look to the ACLU as a savior. What did you mean by that? Can you provide some examples of your thinking on that score?
The main thing is just, you know, we're in this moment where there's, for good reason, a lot of concern about what we have referred to as the rule of law and this idea that it's the judicial branch that is going to protect us from Congress, the legislative branch, and the executive, Trump administration. But the problem with that is that the federal courts are also, you know, not necessarily going to be the sort of bastion of protections and civil rights expansion. This is a very conservative system, and that in our haste to challenge the Trump administration, I just think it's really important that we don't get complacent and look to the federal courts as the sole and most important solution when the resistance that we really need to build is one that prioritizes redistribution of resources and one that really focuses on building power in communities and ensuring that people are getting the basic survival needs met that they have, rather than just, you know, having courts enjoin certain aspects of Trump's most egregious policies. I think we're going to see a lot more damage done in a lot of less profile context, and we need to be able to fight back in multiple ways, not just in the federal courts.
It seems like legal strategies are just sort of like a rear guard action to protect the community against the worst excesses, and we really need to work outside of the legal system and, as you said, build community. That's really important. Well,
yeah, I mean, it's not that we need to only work outside the legal system, although I think arguably that may be the answer to limit our work in that way. But it's more just we can't resolve to just focus on the courts or to over-glorify the impact of a legal win. Because the reality is you can win a case but still not really see noticeable changes on the ground. It's really about being honest with ourselves about the limitations of the types of strategies that we engage in and being creative and consistent in the ways in which we really build our power for our communities. And so that looks like not abandoning local and state-level work. That looks like ensuring that a win is truly enforced. That means putting money resources into communities and recognizing that ending mass incarceration is a queer issue. It means that ending and abolishing ICE is a queer issue. So it's that, to me, is important to just not lose sight of and be transparent about the limitations of the work and the importance of a multitude of strategies.
What sort of legislative work are you doing right now? What are you working on in the various states and local contexts? What legislation are you working against or working for?
For me personally, I tend to be focused legislatively right now in my work on the defensive work, or what we might call defensive work, although I think it has a real, you know, sort of affirmative strategy to it, but stopping the anti-LGBT bills from passing in state legislatures or at the ballot. So for right now, the two things that I'm focused most on are Prop 1 in Anchorage, Alaska, which is a measure that would repeal municipal protections for trans people and mandate discrimination in municipal buildings. And that is being voted on currently in Anchorage, with mail-in ballots due by April 3rd. So working with the campaign there and, you know, assessing legal options if that does pass. And then, unfortunately, for yet another year in Tennessee, we're seeing an anti-trans bill moving through committee. That state has really prioritized these bills, and we've been able, thankfully, with the work of organizers on the ground in Tennessee leading the way to stop these anti-trans bills, but they do keep coming back. And so focusing on that bill, which is HB 2620 in Tennessee, which comes back up for a committee vote next week on the 27th. Those are the things I'm focusing on right now.
And where do things stand in North Carolina with the anti-trans statewide proposition there that passed? Where do things stand with the new governor? And there was some controversy about this compromise that he worked out?
Yeah, unfortunately, that when Governor McCrory, the former governor who had pushed through and signed HB 2, the anti-trans bill, he was defeated by current Governor Cooper, who campaigned on sort of a repeal of HB 2. When he came into office, he sort of sold out the community relatively quickly and orchestrated what he called a repeal of HB 2, but was really just HB 2 sort of repackaged. So that's the current law, which is HB 142, still targeting trans people, still being challenged in court by us at the ACLU and Lambda Legal. So that case is still pending over sort of HB 2, which is no longer law, but there's some remaining claims over that, and then HB 142, which was the so-called compromise measure that we were sold out to pass.
And you were also involved, as I understand it, fairly significantly in the Chelsea Manning case. Might you give us a brief introduction to her circumstances and the legal issues being disputed? What was her incarceration like? It was very, very grim, wasn't it?
I started representing Chelsea Manning in 2013, right after she was sentenced. She was sentenced to 35 years in prison, in military prison, for turning over documents to the news media that, you know, she turned over for purposes of, you know, the benefit of the public interest. And she was prosecuted and charged under the Espionage Act, and the ACLU had been involved in her case from basically the time of her arrest in 2010. But I came to the ACLU in 2013 and started working with her after she came out as trans, which was right after she was sentenced. And I was counsel in her case challenging the Department of Defense's refusal to provide her medical care related to her gender transition. But she went through a lot in custody and spent some very traumatic and horrible times in solitary confinement, first in Kuwait and then at Quantico while her court-martial was pending. And then when she was sentenced, she was sent to the disciplinary barrack at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, where she was denied health care. And we were successful in getting her access to hormones while she was in custody.
And you had to fight the army on that, right? You really had to...
Yeah, we filed a lawsuit over that. Ultimately, they gave in on our request for her to be treated with hormones, and they agreed that it was medically necessary, but they had been denying it anyway. They continued to fight over her ability to grow her hair. That part of the case was still pending when former President Obama commuted her sentence, and she got out in May of last year.
Kind of starting to wrap up here, I'm wondering, what does the future of transgender and queer advocacy look like to you? How important will legal avenues of redress be in the coming years?
I think, unfortunately, we're going to continue to face a lot of assault from state lawmakers and local law enforcement, and the federal and Trump administration is very clear that they are continuing to target trans people and not enforce existing protections or roll back protections that we gained during the Obama administration. So I think the future is really going to be about continuing to fight efforts to erase our identities, to continue to move forward with a plan to talk about gender liberation in ways that really affirms and supports our ability to live safely in our body and to determine how our bodies should be treated and operated in the world. And so that means filing lawsuits for sure. There's going to be policies that need to be challenged. It also means continuing the really exciting work that we're seeing in public discourse and popular culture to continue to really allow for and fund trans representation in meaningful ways and include non-binary folks and prioritize trans femme people of color in these conversations. And so I think there's a lot of collaboration to be done in the future across movements and across strategy, and that we can't be sort of lulled into complacency no matter who's in office at any level of government, because at the end of the day, even if we have good laws on the books, it takes an extreme amount of vigilance to ensure that people are safe and free to sort of build their lives and families and communities in ways that are authentic to them.
Yeah, and it just seems so kind of, I don't know, depressing to have such an adversarial relationship with Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, who seems bent on discriminating against queer folks. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, it's not just about the Attorney General or the Secretary of Education or of Housing and Urban Development. I mean, they're all people who are part of this agenda at the federal level to, build a white supremacist government, to target LGBT people, to target people with disabilities, to enforce immigration laws in this incredibly punitive way to expel people of color. So it's an all-out assault on so many people and communities, and with such corruption and sort of just blatant disregard for law or process at every level. So it's hard to even begin to figure out what is going on and sort of who's targeted and how. It's just, we know that the effects are going to be felt so many different ways. So it's Sessions, it's DeVos, it's Carson, it's Pence, it's Trump, it's all of them, and it means that we can't rely on federal agencies to try to enforce existing civil rights laws in the ways that we could during the Obama administration. And so we have to find other ways to protect each other and our communities, because it's clear that this government has no interest in protecting anyone but rich white people.
It's sort of strange that these days progressives find themselves making states' rights arguments against the federal government, because in recent memory, it's been sort of the opposite way. The recalcitrant white supremacist and sexist and anti-immigrant forces were the ones claiming states' rights. Now it's progressive folks and queer folks that are going around saying, wait a minute, the states have rights against the federal government. So it's kind of just this weird flip-flop.
Yeah, and it's a reminder that it's not like there's a clear principle that cuts across context and is always right. There's always, you'll claim you have a right to something and someone else that you disagree with will claim they have a competing right to be free from that very thing. I mean, it's not states' rights versus the rights versus federal government, in sort of expansion of federal power. It's really about what is our vision of justice? What does it look like, and how can we get there? Because the same thing was true under during the W. Bush years, that it wasn't like the federal government was protecting a lot of communities under Bush, that we built a lot of the systems that are currently being utilized now to harm people. And going back as far as Clinton, you can look to former President Clinton as the source of a lot of damaging laws and policies that are now being used to target our communities and others. And so it's just a matter of remembering that there's always people who are willing to sell you out and hurt you in the government. So we really have to be able to show up for each other and to challenge those actions.
Well, do you have any closing thoughts or suggestions you'd like to make to our listeners?
Keep educating yourself and challenging yourself to show up in meaningful ways for other people when you have power, especially. use that power to be the voice or sort of stand in front of and protect the person who's being harmed and targeted. I think the more we do that for each other, the safer, the better, the happier we'll be. And so there's just a lot to be done. I think it's also an exciting time in terms of resistance strategies, and I think people are really going to make important and lasting changes.
We've been speaking with Chase Strangio. Chase is a staff attorney with the ACLU's LGBT and AIDS Project. He does work on impact litigation, legislative and administrative advocacy, and specializes in the treatment of transgender and gender nonconforming people in police custody, jails, prisons, and other forms of detention. Chase, I'm a big fan of you and your work, so it's really been an honor and a pleasure to have you here on Outsources. Thanks so much for taking the time.
All right, sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Please stay tuned for our events and announcements section.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Boulder is in the process of forming a number of new groups. There's an LGBTQ youth of color group. There's a group called Out and About for all manner of LGBT folks. There are two Dungeons and Dragons groups forming. There is an Introduction to Buddhism group. And last but not least, there is a creative writing group. So if you are interested in any of those groups or more than one, please consult the Out Boulder website, which is www.outboulder.org/calendar. And as always, please stay tuned next week for another exciting episode of Outsources.